Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I am really privileged today to have an extremely successful bass player. We're going to give some love to the rhythm section. This guy's really an amazing, amazing, talented guy, and he's just a really kind, genuine, nice person. We're here with Mike Brignadello, and anybody probably north of Nashville can say that name better than south of Mike spent most of his adult life as an A-list first call studio musician in Nashville. He's played for artists as diverse as Blake Shelton, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Trace Adkins, Vince Gill, Emerson Hart, Tim McGraw, Amy Grant, Faith Hill, Jewel, Luke Bryan, Darius Rucker, Dwayne Eddy, and hundreds of others. I don't even know if I can continue this, man. I feel like we should have a Mike Brignadello wing set up now. Raised in Memphis and steeped in the rich musical tradition of the city, he migrated to Nashville in 1983, and he began a busy studio career recording groundbreaking records with Christian artists Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, Stephen Curtis Chapman, and others. In 1988, he moved out west to L.A., and he began a five-year stint with the rock band Giant featuring Dan Huff. Giant released Last of the Runaways in 1989 on A&M Records and Time to Burn on Epic Records in 1992. They toured extensively in Europe and the U.S. and hit a top 20 hit in 1990 with a power ballad called I'll See You in My Dreams. And anybody who hasn't seen that, you should check it out. It's a good... And you know what, man? You still have like most of your hair. I'm very impressed. Because I watched that video last week in anticipation. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And honestly, though, check out Giant. They're in a phenomenal band. When Giant disbanded in 1993, Mike moved back to Nashville just in time for the explosion in country music. He played bass on scores of multi-platinum records, including Breathe by Faith Hill, Country Club by Travis Tritt, Not a Moment Too Soon by Tim McGraw, I Need You, Leanne Rimes, Hillbilly Deluxe, Brooks and Dunn, and dozens of others. In 2008, he reunited with Amy Grant for the Lead Me On 2008 tour, which led to the opportunity to co-produce and play bass on several songs on Amy's record, Somewhere Down the Road, which was released in 2010 on EMI. And this is really unusual, especially in Nashville. You don't usually have a touring musician also play in the studio. That's because Mike's Mike. In 2010, Mike... You kept using your last name. I'm not going to do that. In 2010, Mike and founding Giant member drummer David Huff reformed the band Giant, and they released Promised Land on Italy's Frontiers Records. The 13-song CD included two videos, one for the single Promised Land and a making of the video Diary. The new lineup featured Terry Brock from Strange Ways on vocals and John Roth from Winger on guitars and vocals. Mike's been able to maintain a varied musical diet by working on Lynyrd Skynyrd's latest record, Last of a Dying Breed, which was released in 2003. Former Tonic frontman Emerson Hart's solo effort, Cigarettes and Gasoline, and Jewel's 2009 release Perfectly Clear. He manages to stay in touch with his Memphis roots by gigging with his 8-piece soul band Grooveyard, fronted by John Cowan. We'll talk about that. Did I say his last name right? Cowan?
Yes. Okay. Uh-huh.
Brignadello remains in the thick of the Nashville studio scene, playing bass on records by Darius Rucker, Blake Shelton, Kip Moore, Luke Bryant, and many others. He finished 2013 playing at the annual sold-out Christmas tour with Amy Grant and Vince Gill. When he's not busy in the studio or on the road, Mike spends much of his time in his home studio creating bass tracks for clients all over the world. Now, this is dead serious. This month, October 2017, Mike released a brand new single called New Year's Day, along with another legendary bassist, Chuck Rainey. I would encourage everybody right now, stop what you're doing, put down your cell phone, like turn it on, whatever, silent, vibrate, whatever, and just go to YouTube and look at this song. It's an amazing song. It's two bass players, actually. And when I first saw that, I'll be honest with you, I said, oh, this is going to be like Mike's doing some arts you know, artsy. This is going to be an artsy jazz thing, but it's not. This is the badass greasy funk, man. I was really blown away, man. And I'm not just saying that. It's really good. So put down your phone, hit the pause button and check that out. Then come back and you get a little taste of Mike and then you can learn about him. So, hey man, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Craig. My pleasure, man. Good to be here.
You got it, man. This is like really impressive. Are you sure you're on the right? Are you sure you're on the right show?
Thanks, man.
Hey, Mike. So you've worked with so many cool people and really interesting, successful people. And I was curious. I'm going to read off a few of them. How'd you get the gig from these things? And from working together, what might have been the biggest takeaways or lessons you learned in these particular situations? So I'll go down a few. Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Well. I mean, they're an American rock icon, no doubt about it. So, I mean, you know, you walk in and there's a certain history and pedigree that's just there. when I got the call, for some reason, somebody sent me a little link to Rolling Stone 100 Greatest Rock Records of All Time, and I think they've got two of them, with Freebird and Sweet Home. So it's that, but I've known the guys for a while. I really like them personally. They're Southern boys like me, and we share a lot of things in common. I really like them. I've played with them off and on through the years. I've done little sit-in and one-offs and little pieces of things here and projects there. And this is the first full studio record that I did with them. And I loved it. And the thing that my takeaway with them would be the attention to detail might surprise people. Every single note was considered on that record that everybody played. I mean, they know how that machine works. And basically my job was just to fit in that machine because it's been running, 40 years now.
Yeah.
And so I was just trying to be, you know, be part of that smooth machinery. And we hit a groove. It was a pretty awesome week. I really loved it. I really did. I've always had a weak spot for their music anyway. I loved them as a kid growing up. So pretty easy for me to slide in there.
Was Artemis was there?
No. They used a buddy of mine. The rhythm section was another studio buddy of mine named Greg Morrow. Who's worked for them off and on through the years, and he actually recommended me for the gig. They were, you know, kind of looking around for somebody to, you know, to fill a slot, and he recommended me, and it really worked out well. It turned out to be a great record.
That's great, man. You know, when you said that, the attention to detail, the reason why I mentioned Artemis is I've interviewed a few guys now on the Artemis Pyle project.
Yeah,
and to a man, they all said they because, you know, you and I are the same age, and we all grew up listening to Skynyrd, and they basically said, and these guys are all our age, and they basically said they had to unlearn everything because the way they grew up playing these songs, they didn't know the detail going on behind the scenes.
It's unbelievable. People, I mean, they're not a jam band.
No.
I mean, they obviously stretch out and jam and solo and all that, but I mean, There's definitely a method to the madness. They figured it out. They know exactly what they're doing.
Well, there's like on YouTube, there's the isolated bass track, I think, from like Simple Man or something.
Yes.
Holy crap.
Now he, Leon was, I mean, genius is overused, but let me put it this way. I think he's probably one of the most underrated bass players ever in the history of American rock. Once you dig in and to those things and you realize, and again, it's not a random thing. His part is repeatable, is playable, is typically the other thing too is that there was a guitar player doubling the bass part. Note for note on many, many of those records.
Oh, I didn't know
so,
that.
So, I mean, so the whole band, I mean, if I would show up to maybe think about sitting in with them, I better know that record bass part because the whole band knows the exact part. You know what I mean? Wow. And it's sort of been crystallized. You know, that's the way it is. And I mean, you play, you're either 100% right or you're wrong.
Yeah.
You know, there's no in between.
Yeah.
That
was really impressive to hear that.
Yeah.
So, Darius Rucker, how'd you get the gig, and what did you learn from that experience?
That was actually the producer, Frank Rogers, called me. I'd worked with him on a whole bunch of different things, and he called me. He was having a really successful run with Darius, producing him, and called me. And Darius, he's a really cool guy. He's like one of the guys. He likes to hang. He likes to talk sports and, you know, music and whatever, and we'll hang out and talk and whatever. And he, you know, he knows what he wants. He knows what he does and all that. But he's kind of, you know, he just kind of one of us. He goes with the flow and real, very chilled out. Just a cool guy. Was not domineering at all. Was open to suggestions. You know, just it was kind of pretty loose and breezy, and it was fun.
So that's a good. That's like a, you know, a lot more he takes your creativity into account.
Yeah, you know, I think it's probably because he's had so much success, you know, in his career. I think he's not worried about thinking about trying to micromanage, you know, every person and what everybody does. He knows that, you know, we're going to come and bring our best, and the producer's not going to let stupid stuff slide, and the engineer is not going to let it set. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think he's pretty comfortable in that. I think he realizes, you know, he liked the team that he had. I know that he definitely liked working with Frank. I don't think they're working anymore together, but they had a long run. I was sort of in the middle of that. I think he was in his comfort zone. So he felt like he could just kind of be loose and have fun with it.
That makes a lot of sense, what you just said. And because he's not just a guy who's like an artist. He's fronted a band.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, he's looked like how much success he's had. And then has done it all again. I mean, he's legitimately, you know, he's not like, you know, a lot of people come here sort of when their career is done and they figure, well, I can hammer out
a squeeze, milk a few. Yeah, squeeze a few.
Yeah, and it's really not so. I mean, yeah. it doesn't work that way. But he is authentic, you know, it was from the South and all that stuff. Was accepted by the audience. I think they spotted a genuineness in him that's not fake, that's real. Mm. He's just being himself. And, you know, has got a really and he's still rolling. I mean, he's still rocking right along.
Yeah.
So
he didn't come here just to squeeze a few years out. He came because he actually had a passion for the music.
No. And he, you know, has made a string of really successful record and is still going.
That's awesome.
So hats off to him.
For sure. All right, how about Vince Gill, man? I know you had to learn a lot from that guy.
Man. Yeah, he's probably maybe one of the best musicians I've ever worked with.
Wow, that says a lot.
Because he's got just so much going on, so many levels. Genius guitar playing, that voice, his songwriting ability, he can produce records. He's like a very quiet intensity in the studio. He's always relaxed. He loves jokes. He tells a lot of jokes. He's really funny. He got a great sense of humor. But I can tell, even with all that, the song is whatever we're about to do is in his head. And he'll sit down and pick up a guitar, and he won't say anything. He'll just quietly start kind of noodling around, and eventually, the musicians sort of quiet down and kind of coalesce around him. And without saying or doing really anything at all, you know, he's kind of leading the way, you know, and the way he'll play it will tell us the vibe, the tempo, the feel, the way he sings it will tell us the intensity, all that stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just, and he's pretty nonverbal in the sense that he doesn't give orders. He doesn't tell people what to do. He just expects you to, you know, use your ears and your experience and all that. And play the right thing.
So he's very, like, what I got out of that is that he's very deliberate in what he's doing, and the intensity is, it's not random as most successful things in life. It's not random. He's extremely deliberate and focused.
Yeah, and I think it's in deliberate is not in the sense that, like, okay, we're going to go A, B, C, D, we're going to do this, that, and the other. It's not that. It's just, I think it's more an intensity, just sort of, he's just quietly focused. And when he sings, when he plays, he, you know, he's not doing anything showy, but maybe it's just because it hits me that way. It's just like it demands that you listen.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just so expressive, powerful, beautiful, however you want to say it.
Sure.
You know, whether he sings or whether he plays, it's, you know, it's there.
you had mentioned he has a good sense of humor. I don't know if you heard this story. I'll tell you. If you heard it, tell me to shut up. Jerry McPherson was touring with him, and they would check into hotels, and Vince Gill would check in as Vince Gill. So Jerry would turn around and says, "Hey, you know, Vince, I'm just curious, you know, people call you there." He goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, what do you do?" He goes, "I talk to him." And Jerry was like,
"Yeah, yeah."
He's like,
"I know."
He's
pretty
like,
much it.
Yeah, yeah. He's like really ultra mellow and like, you know, that was really funny, I thought.
You know, I think, is that so hard?
Hey.
Yeah, I think it's more, you know, just of a quiet intensity. I mean, you know, he's got that song in his head, and you know, I mean, again, he doesn't say, you know, "Hey, drummer, do this. Hey, bass player, do that." I've never heard him do that to anybody. You know, and I think, you know, if we were to take it and drive it off the tracks, I'm sure he'd, you know, say something. But typically, he's trying to round up a crew that's not going to do that to begin with.
Well, yeah, he's got guys like you coming in there.
And typically, it's only going to need, you know, some minor tweaking. It's not going to need a whole, you know. So it's that. But I think he directs just – he kind of leads by example, you know. It's sort of easy to follow a guy like that because he's sort of blazing the trail.
What do you think – so – that's really interesting. So a guy like Vince is not making suggestions, yet he's able to bring out such tremendous performances out of the people he works with. How does that happen? You know, it's like, I guess, how a good producer could
do that. You know, part of it is that when you throw somebody who's really tremendously talented in any pool, whether it's athletics or music or whatever it is, it hopefully, you know, I think it tends to raise the bar. I think everybody tends to up their game a little bit more.
Okay.
I think they listen a little bit harder. I think they pay a little bit attention a little bit more. I think they concentrate a little bit more. I think they're drawn in a little bit more. You know, I think it's all those sort of intangible things. It's. I think it's more that.
Gotcha.
Vince is so incredibly good. I mean, it would be embarrassing if you showed up and played lame.
Yeah.
You would just embarrass yourself, you know.
Yeah.
When he sings, I mean, he's bringing it. You know, he's bringing so much passion. It's just like, why wouldn't you? You know what I mean? Those kinds of things. I think it's that.
That makes total sense. So he's bringing in a great team to begin with, and on top of it.
Right.
He's Vince Gill.
So he's inspiring everybody to, you know, bring it up a notch.
That makes a lot of sense. Hey, so what prompted you to move out to LA when you left town?
Well, I had commuted out there for several years, you know, doing sessions and stuff like that, back and forth and working and all that. And then my good friend Dan Huff moved out there and just lit the town up and decided that he would start a band. And asked me if I would be interested, and so I said yeah.
Okay.
And started commuting out there, and the commitment to the band took off pretty quickly. So I just had to make the commitment to move. So it was basically joining the band Giant is why I moved.
Okay, makes total sense. Mm-hmm. How are the sessions, if they are, different in LA versus Nashville?
God, in a whole bunch of ways. Back in the day when I was out there, there was actually a pretty big session scene, and it's not nearly as big now as it used to be. They still do a tremendous amount of movie and television work, stuff like that. And of course, there are sessions and records being made and all that stuff. I just don't think it's the sheer volume that it was back in the 80s and 90s. In Nashville, we do a whole bunch of different kinds of sessions. We do publishing demos. We do, you know, regular master sessions. We do like Christian and gospel sessions, sort of have their own scales and their own subculture and their own way of running things and all that. So there's a lot of different situations like that. And the, most of the sessions that I saw in LA were straight up on the card union sessions, and you were either cutting a record or you were doing a motion picture or a television day. So you were doing, they were both pretty high profile, pretty well paid sessions. Those were sort of the categories that sort of dominated. And here there was always a mixture. Demo, publishing demos pay at a lower rate than masters and all that sort of thing, right? And so there was all sorts of pay scales and all sorts of different things going on. Because the Nashville music industry really had always been based on publishing, number one. So publishing demos, it's like they realized none of these songs are going to get cut. You can't pay a master scale. They're really, they're just demos, right?
Right.
To pitch to artists to cut them, right? So it's a lower scale. And so all these different sort of categories of work sort of beget these different scales to sort of cater to these different industries, right? So there was that. So the pace out in LA, typically you'd show up, you'd spend one session, one whole 3-hour session playing one song.
And, Nashville, is it?
Everybody made big bucks and everybody was fat and happy and it was great. And here, it wasn't like that. Back in the country days, way before I was here back in the 50s, everything was based on efficiency, and they still wanted to get like 3 songs per master session. So classic country songs like Crazy and He Stopped Loving Her Today and all this stuff were cut at the rate of probably an hour a song.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's crazy. They always prided themselves on efficiency here. And so a lot of that went on. So it's kind of a different mindset. It's still a bit that way. Now, there's tons of other things. There's sort of indie scenes and, people like me doing their own thing and all this and that. Some of it is, kind of union covered work. Some of it's not. Some of it's independent. Some of it's, it's all sort of different kinds of stuff. It's all sort of a big hodgepodge. And I think that's one of the reasons that Nashville has still remained. It hasn't turned out, has hit with the, music industry changed, so much since 2000, because the music industry here is so diverse. It's spread over so many different kind of categories. We've been able to kind of truck right along.
So you could still make a living there, even if you're not Mike Brignadello.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. There's all kinds of people doing millions of things here. Being artistically satisfied, being able to, pay the rent and all that kind of stuff. So,
sure.
Yeah.
How'd you meet Dan originally?
Playing sessions. We hooked up in the very front end of all the contemporary Christian music with Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, and all those artists, back then who kind of broke that scene wide open back in the day, Stephen Curtis Chapman. And I just met him in the session trenches. And, we became friends and hit it off, and obviously you could see he was a phenomenal guitar player. And then we only worked together for a few years, and then he moved to LA. And then I would see him when I'd go out there and do sessions. We worked on a lot of the same sessions together out there that I would go do. A lot of the Christian artists began cutting their records in Los Angeles. So we'd go out there.
That's surprising.
They'd hire Dan. They wanted to avail themselves of the caliber of musicians that were out there. And there was also a pocket of engineers that they worked with. There was just a level of talent out there that, back in the day, this was in the early mid 80s. Back in the day, it wasn't in Nashville like it is now. You don't have to go anywhere to get any world class anything here anymore.
Okay.
But back in the day, and it was a different way of doing things, and they just wanted something different. So
sure.
It was that. So I kept up with him through that. And then when he, decided to form the band, he gave me a call, and the rest is history, as they say.
How does someone say, "No, Dan, I don't want to be in a band with you"?
that's the reason that I joined the band, was really to work with him,
because
I've got this nasty habit of, I was living in Memphis before I moved to Nashville, and I had worked really, really, really hard to kind of get a little career going and get my reputation and all that. And I was working with, four of the busiest bands in town and, eking my way into the session world down in Memphis and all this. And about the time that I kind of really hit my stride, I left Memphis and moved to Nashville.
And had to start all over again.
I did this exact same thing here. I worked really, really hard here for about 5 or 6 years and really kind of got things rolling. And, I was playing on all these records and whatever. And then I decided to quit and moved into LA. So, yeah.
What made, so I should have asked you, what made you move to Nashville then?
That was actually crossing paths with Amy Grant.
Oh, okay.
I was playing with a Christian band down in Memphis called the Garland Key, one of the first like Christian rock bands, back in the day. And her management called and they wanted to hire a band to play with Amy, who was then basically kind of a folk singer. It was her and her guitar. Mm-hmm. And they wanted a band to do a couple of shows with her. So we went and did these two concerts. I think it was in Oklahoma or Texas somewhere. And they brought a mobile unit and recorded both nights. And they used every minute we played.
Wow.
And got Amy Grant Live Volume 1 and Amy Grant. And then a year later, they released Amy Grant Live Volume 2.
From the same night? Literally,
yeah. Well, from two different nights. From we played two nights. And anyway, so from that experience, I met obviously her and her producer, Brown Bannister. And Brown suggested that I, you know, give Nashville a shot. And I did and was, you know, was eager to come up here and get something going. So I did. And, you know, it kind of took off right away. I was really, really fortunate.
Well, but you paid your dues, though, in Memphis.
Yeah. You know, I mean, probably, you know, no more or less than anybody. I mean, I played, you know, as a kid in high school, and then I came out of high school and hit the road immediately, just right after I graduated, just hit the road and was gone. And just, you know, knocked around, just sort of paid my dues, learned what it was all about, and was just kind of knocking around and you know, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And the idea of being a session player, it had really sort of taken hold in my brain. I realized that so many of the people, bass players that I admired were session players. And I thought, man, I think I want to do that. But there really wasn't a whole big session scene in Memphis. So when I got the opportunity, you know, when Brown Bannister suggested that, I jumped on it.
That's pretty good. But yeah, so Brown got you to gave you the opportunity or suggestion to come to Nashville. And then
yes.
Dan... But how do you know? I mean, seriously, though, how would you say, like, if Dan Huff says, hey, I would like you in a band with me, like, what do you need to do? Find a better guitar player?
Well, you know, you have to understand. I mean, back then, I mean, Dan was, to me, in other words, you say Dan Huff, and there's a certain connotation. It didn't have that connotation back then. You know what I mean?
Yes.
He was a noted session player.
Right.
He was the top guy in LA, no doubt. I mean, he was tearing it up and playing, you know, on, I mean, every other hit that was on the radio. So it was that, but he wasn't like, you know, now he's like this legendary producer and has, you know, produced, I mean, Lord knows how many records. He's probably responsible for the sale of 100 million records at this point. You know what I mean?
Wow.
All the stuff he's produced, Keith Urban and all these massive, and all the stuff that he says, but back then he was just, he was a hot session player, but in my eyes, he was the way you seem, because I'd never been around somebody that musically gifted.
Okay.
And so I went out there basically just to work side by side with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was an intense, it was a fast and furious 5 years, and I learned so much. I'm eternally grateful for those 5 years.
Well, that was my next question. What was your biggest takeaway and like, what were the most important lessons you learned from that entire experience? Because you were all like really good musicians.
Yeah, I think what I learned from Dan was just a level of intensity that I hadn't understood before, and how much focus it's possible for someone to bring to a situation. I've never seen anybody more focused. It's like a laser with him. And because of that, his musical instincts are just like I've never seen before. He really can hone the essence of whatever it is, a song, a track, of a guitar part, a solo, whatever it is, and figure it out in the speed of light and execute it. His musical intuition is pretty mind boggling.
that's a really good musical intuition. That's a really good way to describe that. Hey, tell me about Grooveyard.
Grooveyard is, I grew up in Memphis and listened to R&B my whole life as a little kid growing up. And you know, I'm always going to love that music because it was like the music of my childhood. And so when I got to Nashville, there was little or none of that. And so just kind of missing playing that music, my buddy Greg Morrow and I,
the drummer,
had an idea to put together a solo band. And we recruited a guy named John Cowan, who plays bass with the Doobie Brothers now.
Okay.
And we recruited a keyboard player named Reese Winans, who used to be Stevie Ray Vaughan, co-wrote Crossfire. I mean, a heavy hitter on keyboards. We've got Reese Winans on keyboard. He's been with Joe Montemassa now for years.
Right.
But we recruited him and put together a band around those guys. Pat Gannon on guitar. We've had a three-piece horn section. Anyway, it's an old school soul band. It's a three-piece horn band, and we do old soul music. We do Marvin Gaye and Al Green and old soul music, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. Really kind of funk. And we just kind of play around town, and we're not able to do it much anymore because everybody's out touring, everybody's so busy, but we had a little reunion this past April and sold out
our
favorite little venue here, Third Lindsley. Really, really a fun time. Everybody was still kicking, and I was really proud of the band.
That's awesome. So is this your band? Like, do you run it, or?
Yeah, but it's a pretty loose, to say I run it, that's sort of like saying I herd cats.
Okay, I get it.
I mean, it's typically when everybody's, you know, got a break from touring. It just so happened that the Doobie Brothers had a break, and then Joe Bonamassa had a break. And so we had, you know, two of our key guys were in town, and were able to throw this gig together and do it.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, it's like that. We put out a little CD that we've got. People can hit me up on Facebook if they want one. But it's just us playing some of our old favorite solo songs. We don't do kind of like the old Moldy Chestnut, Knock on Wood, and all that kind of stuff. It's a little bit more obscure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely in that vein of old school soul.
That's so you're more like you're the organizer, not really the team leader, quote unquote.
You don't need a leader in this band.
Yeah,
you got some. We've got eight leaders in this band.
That's awesome. Well, hopefully you get to go out again soon, man. This sounds like a nice fun project.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah. It's pretty mighty.
Hey, so let's talk about your new single that I talked about earlier. It's called New Year's Day. Now everybody put down your phone. No, I mean seriously, put it down. Thank you. This is a single, Mike's new single is called New Year's Day. Before I listened to it, as I said, I was really wondering, like, no guitar. I was like, okay. All right.
I'm at the wrong podcast, aren't I?
Yeah. No, I was thinking, like, you know, I thought it was like an art, you know what I mean? Like by an art project where people do like stuff like that, where like, right? You know what I'm talking about? Where someone like.
I can't do art projects. I don't know what any of that is. That's way above my favorite.
You know, instead, you know, they'll have like a bouzouki and like a clarinet and like, you know, a guy on a timpani or something like that. And it's like, you know, somebody's going to talk about, you know, how it's. Anyway. But man, what a great. Man, what a nice, funky piece of music. And so I'm curious, like, how that all came together.
Yeah, well, thanks for saying. The song is definitely not artsy. It's not jazzy. I don't know how any of that stuff works. But it's an old school soul groove. It's just sort of I default to, because again, when I say little kid, I mean my first exposure to like old soul, like Stax soul music was like 5-6 years old. My brother and I had these little transistor radios, and the radio stations that you could pick up in Memphis on these little cheap transistor radios were WDIA and WLOK, which were 24-hour R&B stations, black music.
Out of where? Chicago or something?
Out of Memphis.
Out of Memphis.
Right, okay. Out of Memphis. And they were, I think they were big, you know, wide stations or whatever, but that's what we could pick up as kids. And so we listened to Otis Redding and Aretha Franklin and Albert King and all that stuff as little bitty kids. And to me, just like, I feel like I was the luckiest kid in the world to have grown up listening to that.
That's timeless,
my mother listened to, you know, in the car radio, like top 40 radio or whatever, you know, it popped at the Beatles or, you know, whatever was, you know.
Rolling Stones or
Eagles.
Simon
or
and Garfunkel.
Whatever was pop music at the time. And we, on our little transistor radio, was with our little one-ear earpiece.
I remember that.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it was, you know, that thing
would
listen to.
That's funny. I haven't even thought of that, man, in probably 50 years or 40 years. The one, it was like a plug, but it wasn't stereo because the radio wasn't. It was
you were getting it in mono anyway.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Why listen to it in stereo?
Right. But you felt, I don't know, like, did you always feel, I always felt like it was really cool. I'd sit in front of my building with the earpiece on. Like, I thought it was really cool. Like, I don't know.
Well, yeah, we'd be in our beds at night when we were supposed to be asleep, listen to that radio station.
No, I did the same thing, man. I did the same thing. So that was the fabric of your youth for the most part.
Yes, yeah. And so anyway, that's this song is that. It's just like an old R&B groove. And the way it came about was, I call it New Year's Day because the writing the song was inspired by this annual dinner that Victor Wooten, one of my bass idols, has.
Sure.
Victor Wooten lives here in town, and he's got this annual dinner on New Year's Day that he does, and he invites a lot of people from the music industry, but the emphasis is on bass players, and we very rarely get to see each other because there's only one bass player per band, one bass player on the session. We don't get to hang out much.
Sure.
And all that stuff. So it's a rare chance for us to gather and hang and whatever, you know, enjoy an evening together. And
that's a really nice, I'm surprised like a lot of people don't do that because that makes a lot of sense.
Well, what Victor tells, you know, all the newcomers every dinner is that he got the idea from he's the famous New York jazz player,
Art Blakey, drummer,
the tall guy,
bass player,
Ron Carter.
Okay.
Yeah, got the, because he apparently does I believe it's him, or yeah, I'm gonna say it's him. Yeah, let's go anyway. Famous jazz bass player has this annual dinner at his house, and you know, Victor's been up to it several times. Victor hangs in those heavyweight circles and all that, and he tells us, you know, he said, I thought it'd be nice. I wanted to be home with my family on New Year's Day.
Sure.
And he said, I thought it'd be nice to try to start the tradition around here. So he's been doing this for years. And
On
New Year's Day.
That's
really
nice.
I go to it every year. And it really inspired me, you know, meeting some people that I didn't know in Tennessee and what they do and what their scenes are and how they sort of skin the musical cat, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really inspired to kind of create something. And my buddy, who really kind of was the genesis of all this, a fellow bass player and a guy named Rod Taylor, suggested that I do a duet with Chuck Rainey. I met Chuck through Rod Taylor a couple of years ago at a dinner at Rod's house. And Chuck and I hit it off and became friends and kind of kept up with each other. And he would come to town from time to time and I would see him, go out and hear him play and all that. And I was a big fan, grew up. You know, huge fan of Aretha Franklin, and that's Chuck Rainey, and a huge fan of Steely Dan, that's Chuck Rainey.
Yeah, I didn't realize he was behind Steely Dan. I looked him up after I read.
Man, listen to the Asia record. I mean, he's given a lesson on every cut.
Yeah.
And you know, the more I know him, and he played on Groovin' by the Young Rascals.
Yeah, that's a great song.
He's played on so many, you know, so many things, but. But anyway, so my buddy Rod kept saying, you should make this a duet. And so I'm like, I was kind of, you know, bashful and shy to ask him. Anyway, send a little demo. He heard it. He liked it. He agreed. And so I just set up a session around. I knew he was going to visit Nashville this past summer. So I rounded up my buddy Greg Morrow again on drums and my friend Steve Nathan on keyboards, two of the, I think, some of the best top musicians in Nashville. And the four of us went in the studio and did it. Just two bass players, keyboards and drums.
That's amazing.
And nothing else. And when I finished the session and listened to what I had, it's like I didn't think it needed anything else. So I just sort of stopped. and so it became that.
It doesn't need anything else. It's really
well,
it's,
thanks.
Man, it's really you don't hear funk music like that anymore. Not with that kind of greasy funk, you know.
It's definitely harkening back. I mean, I think I hear a lot of sort of the stuff, music of my roots. I hear it coming back in various places and stuff like that. I mean, it's hip to say that you don't like it now because it was so overplayed and so worn out. But Uptown Funk, I just loved. I mean, you know, and it's like sort of bringing back that old style, you know, soul music. And there are bands. There's a band called Wolfpack that I love that plays that sort of funky stuff, Snarky Puppy. And some of these young kind of, you know, alt funk bands are bringing some of that old school stuff back. And there's kind of a resurgence of that. It really sort of never died in England. In London, they've always, you know, had a soft spot for that kind of R&B. But I've always loved it. So I knew it would be right up Chuck's alley, and he liked it. So, you know,
man, you want to hear a funny story? You just mentioned London and R&B. So my wife is from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So the first time we're hanging out, we're in my apartment, and I said, "Oh, I'm a smart. I know what she's gonna like." So I go to put some music on. I put on the Beatles, right? Because I know what she's gonna like because she's from England, and one of the reasons we've been together so long is because, and I love her so much, is because she tells me the way it is, and I love that about her. And so she looks over at me and she says, "What the hell is this?"
Yeah.
I said, "Well, I figured you're from England." She goes, "I can't stand this music."
Wow.
So I wound up, what did she like? Like, I think I put on like Curtis Mayfield or Marvin Gaye, I think is what I wound up putting on. Because that's what she wanted to listen to.
Yeah, but that'll always work.
Yeah, man. I was like, and in retrospect, I'm like, no. You're with a woman. You don't put on the Beatles. You put on Marvin Gaye. You put on, you know, something chilled out like that, you know?
Right.
I'll never forget that story, man, the look on her face.
Yesterday. That's right.
What the hell are you doing? Hey, are you working on anything else now that you're excited about?
Well, actually, I'm sort of finishing up kind of releasing this whole little single project because it sort of spawned a couple of videos up. I've got a little video up, you know, to go with a song. It's up on YouTube. Go to YouTube and check it out. Mike Brigadardello, New Year's Day. Give me a like, give me a thumbs up, all that good stuff. But I've also I hired a video team, and we shot the day that we were in the studio. And so I've got like a real video that'll be out in a couple of days.
That's awesome.
Sort of a making of video. And that thing really, I'm really proud of that thing. One of the things that it gets across, I think, is not only how vibrant Chuck still is, but I think you'll see if you check out that video, how loose it was, how we basically laugh our way through the whole day.
You know what? You guys had so much, just in the pictures alone.
You guys had so much
fun. You could see that was like, man, you know, that was such a happy, you know, thing.
It's really like just the four goofballs, you know, hanging around the studio, and they accidentally recorded a song.
I don't think there's anything accidental about that.
But it's kind of like that. You know, I gave no like I tell you, you know, Vince, you know, one of my musical idols. I didn't say anything to anybody, really. I didn't have to. I mean, I played them the demo. You know, we had a little chord chart, and that was all there was to it. I mean, I didn't have to say you do this or you do that or I want this or I want that. I mean, everybody knew what to do. We just laughed and joked around, and eventually wandered out to the studio and just sat down and played it.
And you said the keyboard and the drummer, that was two takes. They got that right.
I tell you, honestly, a lot of what I wound up using was the first take.
Wow.
And I've got, you know, like I say, I've got a few other takes, but majority of both of their performances were either take one or take two.
Wow. So let me ask you this question. So a lot of times guys that play in sessions will tell me, you know, they get frustrated because, you know, what the artist or whoever's paying the bill that day, what they, you know, they may do a solo or play their part, and the artist or whoever's, you know, the producer will say, "Hey, great." And the performer, you know, the musician will say, "Man, that's, I messed up. I had all this stuff in my head." And I get it because, you know, I understand, but the other person doesn't know what's in their head. So they're going like, "Hey, that sounds great. It's take it." What?
Well, yeah, well, what I tell you, what I do as a studio player, and what we all do, and what you should be able to do, everybody is say, no, give me another take. You know, I've got, you know, I messed up this bar and I want to do this. And that happens all day long here. I mean, typically when guys are doing solos, they'll play a solo and go, give me another one. The engineer is already right back, ready to roll again. The player will go, give me another one. And they might do that 5 or 6 times, you know, or they go, okay, I like that, except give me the second bar. And then they'll go do that.
Okay.
And it's that. And so, I mean, this whole idea, there's a sort of, it's like myth about first take. The only reason that I was able to use those guys, it wasn't because they were saying, hey, I'm going to do first take. It's just because they come in playing it at such a high level. Mm. But if it wasn't, you know, what I wanted, I don't care if it's the first take or 101. It doesn't matter. I mean, you need to get what you need to get.
Okay.
And so the idea that I did it in one take, I could give a crap about that. I want it to sound good. And I guarantee you some of the records that you love were not done in one take.
I'm sure. I don't see how that would be possible.
No. I mean, sometimes you get lucky and great, you know, but whatever. I mean, you're going for a feeling. You're going for a spontaneity. You're going for a vibe. And whatever that's achieved, whether it's take, like I say, 1 or 1,000, you know, that's what you want to use.
Right. Yeah, because that was going to be my question. Did you find you had to, like, balance yourself, but you answered that where you wanted a certain thing and they delivered it, so it was case closed.
Right. Yeah. And you know what? And they knew this. I mean, in the day of Pro Tools, which is how everybody records here, mm-hmm. in the state, in the U.S., or most people, many people, or any, let's put it, computerized recording, let's put it that way.
Sure.
Whatever your preference is. Most people have a rig at their home. I don't know one studio musician that I work with who doesn't have his own Pro Tools rig. I've had mine for 15 years, maybe longer. Everybody's got it, and everybody knows how this works. And it's better to have multiple takes. People appreciate passes, and they don't all have to be perfect. But typically, there are different flavors of things and different ideas. People spontaneously play things they won't play on a next pass. And so what I'll do if I'm working with at least a savvy producer is try to give him a slightly different reading every time through the song. And play it a bit different. So if he doesn't like this particular chorus part, maybe he'll like the next one. And then, you know what I mean, use that. Or if I play a fill here that he doesn't care for, the next pass down, there's no fill there.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. And everybody has that in the back of their mind. So as they're working through and doing these things, they're trying to stack me up some parts so I can go through and pick and choose some things. And there were there were definitely times when I, you know, put the thing together that I needed to do that. I would choose to do a certain thing, maybe that Chuck did, or maybe at that moment, maybe what the piano did slightly rubbed. So I'll go find something that doesn't rub, you know, like that.
Okay. So you really, you functioned in this as a proper producer, as far as I'm hearing.
Oh, yeah. I was the producer. Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. I did all the editing and everything. I mean, we cut the tracks. And then I probably spent, because of my work schedule, I probably spent, you know, all the spare time for a month, you know, editing the thing and sifting through and getting it just what I wanted. And then finally, when that was all done and in place, then I just send that to the mixer. The same guy who tracked it, Chris Stone, great engineer here in town, send it to him and it's ready to go. It's ready to be mixed, you know.
Got it.
So it's that. Yeah. But I knew really what I wanted, specifically what I wanted, and I'm pretty anal retentive. And I knew there was no sense in trying to torture somebody else to get it. I might as well just do it.
Yeah, sure. No, it wouldn't make sense in this case to have. So, I mean, you specifically, you know, wrote the piece, handpicked the pieces out, and it's not like this is your first rodeo.
No.
You know, I mean, you knew what you wanted probably better than anybody. You had it in your mind what you wanted. So, I mean, it would, you know, this is probably not a case where you'd need to bring someone else. You probably had the best take anyway.
No. I know what we were doing.
And it sounds wonderful. So there you go.
Thank you.
That's all you know.
Thanks very much.
Oh, man. And it really does. If you can go back and give advice to your younger self, What advice would you have given yourself? I don't know. We don't have long enough, right?
Well, I will say this. You know, I was kind of looking over the questions and thinking about some of them, and like, you know, I don't have many regrets, and because I tried not to do horrible stuff to people. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I didn't. You know, I've always said I've been lazy in the fact that I'm too lazy to lie. You know what I mean? It's
sure.
just it's easier to me to not, and you don't have to keep all that stuff in your head. And it's easier, I think, to just be straight with people and not jerk people around. And because
oh, yeah.
I'm just lazy. I don't have the energy to, you know.
No, it takes
balls.
Work. It takes
so,
work if you're going to do that.
So
for sure.
You know, in terms of that, I guess the only thing that just overall is that, you know, I look back at my younger person, I was, you know, pretty feisty at times, and maybe I could have been a kinder, gentler, you know, soul back then, and maybe not so self-assured, but whatever. But I don't know. I guess the closest I can come to anything that I could say, and this maybe also spills over to the advice, if I had any, you know, what advice would you have to anybody coming into the business? And that is, I used to work for Barry Beckett, God rest his soul, one of the icons of all time. Barry Beckett played keyboards with Rod Stewart and the Rolling Stones and Bob Seger and Linda Ronstadt and Traffic and Simon and Garfunkel, and produced everybody under the planet, produced half of those people, as well as being piano player and band leader. He was just, you know, Google Barry Beckett sometime. Anyway, I used to work for him before he passed away. And in the restroom right outside of his studio, he had a plaque hanging there. So while you stood there, you could read this plaque. And it said, "Be careful of the toes you step on today. They may be connected to the ass you have to kiss tomorrow." And I thought, if the great, legendary Barry Beckett, Barry Beckett has that in his bathroom, if he thinks that's important enough to put up, so much more for, you know, a junior guy like me. So I think it's that. I think it's just, you know, you don't want to burn bridges. You don't want to, you know, you want to be considerate of people. You want to try not to, you know, get too full of yourself, get too arrogant. I mean, everybody's got a season. They're on top for a while and then they're not. So, you know, try to be graceful when you are and all that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think just that.
So that be careful the toes you step on today, because they may be attached to the ass that you need to kiss later on.
Yes, tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Yes.
Okay. So you took heed of that pretty seriously.
Well, the thing that made the impression on me was that Barry Beckett had put it up. I mean, Barry Beckett.
Yeah.
Was you know, I mean, he was financially set for life. Musically, he was set for life. You know what I mean? He had
yeah.
done everything. He was still. You know, I don't know. It's just like, if he puts that up,
yeah.
I mean,
probably should pay it, give it at least a little.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I just wrote his name down. I'm going to check him out.
Google him. You won't believe what you come up with.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I like that. I really like that.
Yeah.
Why bass and not guitar?
I grew up in Memphis. R&B.
Okay, so
yeah,
that was it.
Yeah.
Was your?
I mean, my earliest memories were listening to Stax and Motown.
Gotcha.
I mean, I heard, you know, on that radio station I was telling you about. I mean, that's you know, that was meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
You know, and so for me, I mean, that bass was so powerful. It was just kind of irresistible.
And you said you had who your influences. I mean, you named some of the bands, but who your influences? Anybody in specific?
Well, you know, for me, it was I didn't find out really until much after the fact. I didn't, you know, as a little kid, you hear this stuff and, you know, you don't know who's doing what and whatever and how it all works. And years later, I realized that those early records that I listened to as a little kid, Motown was James Jamerson.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in Memphis, the Stax guy was a guy named Duck Dunn.
Duck Dunn, yes.
Yeah, Donald Duck Dunn. And so those were two of my early. And then my mom, you know, listened to top 40 radio, whatever, heard a lot of Beatles on radio. And then you know, I unlike your wife, I was intrigued by the Beatles, and then later on, of course, figured out McCartney and McCartney's bass playing and what that was, and kind of went back. I kind of heard all this stuff young, and then sort of went back and studied it, you know.
Sure.
And then kind of went back and picked up on it. So, you know, Jamerson, you know, later on, like every bass player, I mean, you know, all the huge ones, Jaco and, you know, all that stuff, you know what I mean? You listen to that, blah, 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 and go, oh my gosh, listen to these guys.
Sure.
But just sort of, and then I realized, you know, studio musicians, and I realized, like this guy named Abe Laboreal out in
LA. Yeah, his kid is a monster drummer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he plays with Paul McCartney.
I know. And Abe Jr. And his dad is a just monster bass player, and well, he's a session player out there. And then I hear about a guy who lives in town, one of, you know, legendary guy named David Hungate. I'm like, wow, listen to this by Skaggs record, and now here's Toto, and it's the same guy, and you know, all this stuff, and it's just like, wow, session players, what's that all about? And so, you know, it was kind of digging in and figuring out what do they do, and what does that mean, and that seems cool, and all that kind of stuff. I kind of figured out a lot of this stuff kind of late to the game a little bit. It just took me a minute to sort of figure out, you know, which end was up, but.
That's interesting. As you said that, I'm sitting there thinking, wow, how clever this guy was and open-minded to be thinking about that. Like, because most people, when they want to play music, you know, if you're a bass player, you're thinking, you know, I had a brain fart, the guy from Cream.
Jack Bruce,
right.
Yeah.
Or you know, you're thinking about specific, you know, Geddy Lee, if you're in the modern day.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But you actually, I was just thinking, man, how clever that was to go behind the scenes.
Well, and here's the thing, too. I mean, you know, once I start, you know, really digging down deep and really chasing it, you know, as a young man and all that, I quickly found out, you know, that Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones both were session players in London.
Yeah.
Jimmy Page played on Hurdy Gurdy Man by Donovan.
Mm-hmm.
He played on, I don't know, some other things. Maybe, well, I know he's in Yardbirds and all that. But John Paul Jones played bass and keyboards and orchestrated for session. He was a session guy over there. Even.
He's an incredibly talented guy.
Oh, my gosh. God. I mean, to me, he was half the band.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because of all the stuff that he brought. But I just thought it was so cool. I think I like the idea of playing different kinds of music, working with different people, and because when you're in a band, I mean, you learn the band set, and then that's kind of it. You learn those whatever 30 or 40 songs, and that's kind of what you learn. And maybe you learn a new song every once in a while. But this was something, you know, the idea of something, wow, something new every day, something different every day, and a new challenge, and you've got to learn this kind of style and that kind of style. And once I got into it, I realized, oh my gosh, I can't read music. That's going to be a road bump.
But so, it wasn't, though, was it?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously I read charts and all that kind of stuff, but, and I read a little bit now, and I did some studying, and you've got to have at least some kind of basic reading, you know, basic musical knowledge,
sure,
how to navigate a chart and that kind of thing. Read rhythms, that kind of thing. You got to at least have some of that. So, you know, I went to work and did some catch up and kind of got up to speed.
But most of the guys, the session guys I've spoken to, very few of them could read music. And in fact, many of them, you know, if I've said, what do you wish you would have done different? Not many, but a couple have said, I think Jeff King said that. And maybe Jerry, I think they said, I wish if I could have read music. I know Jeff for sure said if I could have read music, I think that would have been a little smarter than me.
Well, one of the things, because of the scene that I fell into when I first came to Nashville early on, most of the people in the contemporary Christian scene could read. In fact, many of them were amazing readers. And so it was kind of expected when you were in that scene that you could read, because most of the guys and girls did that. And so I had to get up to speed really quickly, just to just so I wouldn't, you know, drown on some of the sessions. So I never became a great reader because I didn't grow up doing it. But because of that kind of boot camp experience that I had, that intense experience where I had to get up to speed pretty quickly, where it helps now is that when we're on a session and people sing you a line, it helps in being able to write rhythms.
Okay.
So you can quickly write a rhythm accurately. And I noticed, and that's the thing, that people who can't read don't do that. And that's what slows them down a bit, because oftentimes you're sung three or four different lines that are similar, but different. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so if you're not able to specifically write those things, it can be a tangle. So it I think for that, it just makes life a little bit easier for me, because of just little things like that.
Do you think that's been a bit of a differential as to why you've gotten brought on some jobs over some other people?
No, I don't think, because I'm definitely not known as a great reader. In fact, most of the time I lie and just tell people I don't read.
Okay.
because I didn't grow up doing it, and it's a bit of a struggle. And if it's really, really complicated, I'm not the guy and all that.
Okay, I get you. You don't want him bringing you on because you say, yeah.
It's that. Well, the reason that I got into the music business, and the reason that I specifically wanted to be a session player, was not to read somebody else's part. It was to invent my own.
Yes.
You know, and I wanted to be hired for being able to show up and make up a part on the spot.
Totally get that.
And so that I sort of nurtured that, and I wanted to be called for that, rather than I can, you know, cut the dots, so to speak.
Gotcha. Totally gotcha, man. That makes sense. If I asked you to pick your three favorite albums, what are the first three that come to mind?
Man, that would be tough. I didn't start buying records until relatively late in life, you know, like, I don't know, 15 or 16. I was way into sports as a kid.
Okay.
And just that's all I wanted to know about, sports. Baseball to football to baseball to football. Just that was my, you know, I love that.
That's unusual.
But, pardon me?
That's unusual. Most, you know, you're either typically artistically inclined or athletically inclined.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I'm not a big guy, and I've always been thin.
Right.
my junior high school and eighth grade football coach who cut me, who I hated at the time for doing that, he called me Briggs, said, "Briggs, I'm going to do you a favor and I'm going to cut you." He said, "You've got the heart, but you do not have the body for football." Because, I mean, it was that. I mean, I've got broken bones and all kinds of scars from my love of football, but it was that. So when you say favorite record, I didn't kind of start buying them until, like, say, sort of late in life, 15, 16. And then when I did, I started buying them, you know, like a sort of a bunch of ones. And so I kind of think of them kind of in groups. I think my first one might have been Dark Side of the Moon, might have been Led Zeppelin, maybe Houses of the Holy, something like that. Because when I started buying them. It might have gone back and bought like Abbey Road or something like that, or maybe that double white record.
Another great album.
I'm trying to think, and they're kind of in groups a little bit, I think, because I think about sort of, you know, buying Zeppelin records. I think about, you know, one of my first records might have been a Stevie Wonder album. It might have been Inner Visions.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that was.
It might have been somewhere around that time, maybe something like Songs in the Key of Life, probably Inner Visions.
So it was early to mid 70s, probably.
Yeah, probably early 70s. Yeah, like that, and then went back and got, you know, just bought a bunch of Bad Company and Queen and early Zeppelin, early Beatles, you know, all that stuff.
Yes, we got the same record collection. Then. Hey, if you, this is probably a hard one. If you weren't doing what you're doing now, what do you think you'd be doing instead?
Well, it's hard for me to be objective because the last year or so, I've gotten so caught up in video. And I've said a couple of times, if I were somebody starting out today, I mean, I think I'd be involved in creative endeavors one way or the other. You know, I think I'd be drawn to music. I don't know if I'd want to be a session player here in 2017. I think I'd maybe want to make videos. I've made a few, and I really, really, really enjoy it.
That's an exacting. It's not easy doing that. It's a lot of editing. Editing is not easy.
Yeah, it's tedious, but it's.
You find it rewarding, obviously.
I do. It is pretty easy. I don't know. It's just I never have trouble knowing what should come next.
That's great.
Anyway, I think that's maybe what I would chase, just because I'm so intrigued with it now. I've been trying to learn some things about it, and you know. Naturally, the first thing I had to do was buy a new computer.
There you go.
Be able to shove the video, but
yeah, you need
anyway,
high,
that really intrigues me now. I think I'd study video and I'd learn to fly a drone.
Yeah, man, drones are pretty cool. I was just telling my wife that.
Well, you know, because of all the drone work that you see in videos nowadays.
Oh, that's right. So I'd be right together. I smell Plan B for you here, Mike.
I tell you, man, I'm really intrigued with it. Yeah, I'm chasing some other things now, so we'll see what happens.
Oh, good. Happiest moment or time in your life?
I will have to say the Giant era has got to come close to the top because we traveled the world. We toured Europe so many times. We lived in England for 3 months making the first record.
Really? That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, we went to toured Europe and Scandinavia so many times. I mean, I can ride the tube around London to this day. I mean, I know Amsterdam.
That's awesome.
Really well. Not really well, but you know, I can get around just fine. Let me put it that way.
That's awesome.
And just things like that. The last couple of years of Giant, I met my wife, Dee Dee, and I were together then, and she got to do a whole bunch of traveling. I've got pictures of the two of us all over the world. I got a picture of her on the Eiffel Tower and just, you know, all this cool stuff. And it was, you know, we had met and just blah, 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 hitting it off and all that stuff. And it was a great time. It was a blast, you know, music that I was proud of and just all that. It was pretty good.
That's nice, man. Hey, what's your non-musical superpower?
Oh, man. Gosh. I have no idea. I don't know that I've got a superpower.
Everybody's got a superpower.
Man, I don't know. That stumps me. I'm not sure what that would be.
All right. I spoke to somebody recently, and the wife was in the background. And I said, "What's your non-musical superpower?" And the wife said, "He always knows when the batteries are about to go dead."
Oh, wow.
I said, "I guess that is a superpower. I don't have that talent, I tell you that much."
Wow.
Yeah. Favorite place you traveled? Did I ask you that? No. Is it London? No. Would it be London or?
Well,
or England?
I love London, but probably my favorite place is Tortola.
Where
British
is that?
Virgin, yeah, it's British Virgin Islands. My wife and I go there for vacation, and we've been down there several times and just love it. It's really chilled out. Every time you turn the car, you come around a corner, it's another vista. It's another view. It's just
what is that called? Is that like Turks and Caicos? Or it's like in that area?
Well, no, it's down there. You know, it's not as far as south. It's Turks and Caicos, but it's in the British Virgin Islands. It's called Tortola.
T-O-R?
And yeah, T-O-L-A, yeah. And there's a it's a really small island. And there's a little one even smaller than that called Virgin Gorda that's not to be believed. You take a little ferry out to it, and wow. I mean, it's otherworldly. I mean, beautiful beaches. Dee Dee and I like to chill on the beach, and we like relaxing, sunny, warm vacations, and that's probably been one of our favorites.
Very cool. I've never. So, is there anything to do there? Or like, is there a town to go into, or it's really just
There's road town.
Okay.
And there's stuff, and there's restaurants, and and all that. Typically, we rent a home and,
yeah.
and just chill and you know, you'll have your own pool and, you know, all that. And just about, well, every place we've been to, I mean, the views are spectacular. I mean, you're just looking on the blue Caribbean. It's just...
Yeah, that ocean is gorgeous.
It's unreal.
And
yeah.
It's safe because, like, when we went to Turks and Caicos, they were like, you know... Don't go anywhere that's not a resort. Now maybe they were just saying it because they're the resort people. I don't know.
No, that's the thing I like about Tortola. I mean, we love the Caribbean, and we've been to a good handful of islands down there. And I know what you're talking about. There's sort of like the resort inn, and you can go to that, but then don't right. go to the. And we've been to those places, and we don't enjoy them. For a bunch of reasons, but Tortola is not like that at all. It's like I say, it's a British Virgin Island. So it's our experience has been that they seem to run it a little bit tighter than maybe some of the other places.
Yeah.
And there's not some of the weirdness that might float through.
Sure.
You know, maybe in the Caribbean,
yeah.
and maybe some other places that might. So it's that. And the island people are very chill and you know, not strange at all. And the first few times there, now the last couple of times we haven't noticed it. So the first few times we noticed that it seemed like they rang the church bells every day. It seemed like they seemed to be, and we noticed that a lot of the young girls, you know, were wearing, it looked like Catholic schoolgirl uniforms. And we drove through and passed a whole bunch of church services, like on a Wednesday night or, you know, whatever, not Sunday.
Right.
And it seemed to us that it was a fairly churched population, which kind of mellows things out. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
People tend to be a little less out of control.
Yeah, just, yeah. And so just been, like I say, we've really enjoyed it. You know, one of the reasons one of my friends said it's been so great so long, he said the cable was slow getting there, cable television, so I don't know. But yeah, it's beautiful. It's lovely.
I'm going to look that place up because we're looking for a place to go like that, man. I've never heard of it.
Oh, my gosh. I'd hardly recommend it.
Well, I'm going to call you if I go so you can tell me all the hot spots.
Well, they're not
both of them.
Really, I could tell you a few restaurants, you know,
yeah,
but you know, we like to pretty much chill out.
Yeah, I hear you, man. I'm going to ask you three more questions, Mike. What's the toughest decision you ever had to make or the hardest thing you ever had to do?
I think that was when to pull the plug on Giant.
Yeah.
It was, you know, we had worked so hard for 5 years and, just our timing was off. We were just a little bit late to that party.
Mm.
The musical landscape had sort of changed really about the time that our first record was coming out. So we were, you know, always on the sort of the back end of that melodic rock trend.
Yeah.
That
was more, you know, like the 80s, late 80s.
Yeah. And so there was a, you know, we had a business situation that we had to deal with. It cost us a year. So we were just a bit late getting to the party. So circumstances, it's the way the dice roll, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yep. Yep.
It's the way it happened, you know. But anyway, at the end of that 5 years, sort of deciding, you know, now's the time, that was a little bit gut-wrenching at moments.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I could understand that.
Mm-hmm.
What's the you've been on a tremendous musical journey here, and what's the most important lesson all of this, you know, your business basically has taught you?
Well, oh gosh, man, I think it's just a universal thing. I mean, I think the things that work here work in any business, which is just, you know, you've got to treat people, you know, like human beings, even when sometimes maybe they're not treating you like that. And I know that in the entertainment business, there are a lot of situations where people give themselves license to act poorly.
Yep.
But, you know, I think it's up to us not to be sucked along and all that. And so I think it's important that you know, treat people fairly and like humans, and like you would want to be treated with respect and all that. And then I think, you know, you've got to be, you know, at all times, you know, you got to be conscious of, you know, you got to put out top quality, the very best you can possibly do, like at all times. I mean, you catch yourself coasting and you're doing the wrong thing. You can't do that. So, I mean, just kind of those simple things, you know, you got to stay focused. You got to work hard. I'm working as hard now as I ever have. And probably, you know, enjoying things as much as I ever have because of that. But, you know, I think the thing that really appeals to me about sort of music philosophically is that the way I think of it is that you're always on the path and you've never really arrived. There's always something to learn, always something more that you can stretch. You know, you're never going to learn it all. You're never going to kind of get there. You can always strive for it. And I really kind of like that. I like the idea that I can, you know, try to learn something new, you know, every single day and try to get a little bit better every single day.
And you know, you made a comment earlier about it's like any other business, and any business endeavor is like that because you're never going to get, you know, I've run so many different projects and businesses over the last 20 years, and there's always room for growth, you know, and you never can, you're never going to get your hands on it all. And when it comes down to it, that's what makes it fun.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely.
If you know everything, what's the point, you know?
My brother asked me about that the other day. You know, he asked me what I was doing. I said, I was practicing. He said, why are you still practicing? He said, haven't you learned it all yet?
Oh, that's sorry. I didn't mean to laugh like that, but that's just it's funny.
True.
Haven't you learned it all yet? No, that you need another couple of years. Last question, Mike, and you're just a sweet guy. I really appreciate all your time. What's your definition of happiness for right now?
I think it's being able to choose how and with whom you spend your time.
Yeah, man, that's for sure. All righty, man. I'm sorry. Were you going to say something else? I'm sorry.
No. Okay. No. Hey, just that simple.
I cannot thank you enough for your time, and you're a really sweet guy. You're a very sincere person. You're an amazing player, and you know, after speaking with you and listening to your music, there's literally no surprise why you've had such a fantastic career.
But well, thank you.
I want to tell everybody where to find you online. You can find Mike online. Go to YouTube or Facebook. And let me spell his name. It's Mike Brignardello. Brignardello. So it's Brig, Brig, and Nardello at the end of that. So check out his music on YouTube or Facebook. Or go to YouTube, actually, and, you know, give him a thumbs up. The song is called New Year's Day. You can find the music on CD Baby. You can find it on iTunes, Amazon, and at Crazy Eddie. No, they don't have that here.
I remember Crazy Eddie.
You do. He was crazy. Listen, man, thank you. You're a wonderful guy, and I'm really glad I got to meet you. So thanks for everything. And
thanks, Craig. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again to Mike Brignardello for spending his time with us. Good luck with the CD and all the other subsequent recordings after New Year's Day. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with some other cool stuff for guitar players. And be nice. Go play your guitar and have some fun. That's what it's all about. Till next time, I am out. Peace, everybody. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.